Mojave Beach Productions.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana bring you stories of faith and inspiration, made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana present Dear Dean, Love, Mom, made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International and narrated by Esther Luttrell.
From a 4,000-square-foot home to a room in the rear of my Aunt Betty's cabin that measured 10 by 20 feet, I found myself fighting claustrophobia. I set it up so that one end of it held a hot plate, a microwave, card table, and one place setting, plus my toaster and an apartment-sized refrigerator. I set up the center of the room with a door held up by two filing cabinets, which became my desk. On it went the computer, a lamp, and my printer. A six-drawer bureau held my tiny TV set. It divided my office from the bedroom, which consisted of a bed. I'd brought my lace curtains with me and hung them at the cracked windows. Sand, however, well, that was another issue entirely. Yucca Valley sits between Palm Springs, which is several miles below, and Big Bear, several miles above. The shelf it occupies is called the High Desert, ringed on three sides by mountains so high they surely penetrate heaven itself. The highway stretches like a long gray band straight out through Joshua Tree and 29 Palms, all the way into Las Vegas. All earthquakes manage to do is shuffle the sand around a bit. There was sand in my cereal, and sand in my bed, and sand in my eyes, and sand in my hair. Sand in the high desert is a way of life. I'd lay in bed at night, listening to coyotes come down out of the mountains, training their young to hunt for stray cats or small dogs or whatever it is coyotes prey on. You could hear the training sessions in progress, tiny yelps and howls in between more stern yelps and howls, followed by the heartbreaking cry of small captured animals. I killed a scorpion on the wall my first night there. Why, I moaned over and over, would anybody want to live in this godforsaken place? Sun baked the earth, leaving wide cracks snaking across the ground, and nothing green grew anywhere except where one found a lonely yucca tree. So I'd get in the car and I'd drive to, well, really nowhere in particular. One of my nowhere trips took me up a dusty winding trail to a tiny place called Pioneer Town. The bowling alley built by Roy Rogers is still there, but not much else. A saloon, a church. It looks like a Western movie set, which is exactly what it was when Rogers and Gene Autry filmed there in the 40s and early 50s. It'd be years later before Autry would build the ranch where Larry had worked on the Magnificent Seven. Today, a couple hundred or so residents are scattered throughout Pioneer Town and the surrounding hills. But at one time, I even thought about moving there, because not too long after my arrival, a funny thing happened. In the middle of picking sand out of my teeth, I began to notice. I noticed how the mountains turn red-gold at sundown, how the storm clouds churning in from over Palm Springs would tumble up and threatening a violent storm, terrifying in their size, holding blades of lightning that flashed off and on, would hit the tops of mountains and then literally split in two. The clouds would roll to either side of the mountains, leaving our little space untouched. It was amazing. And awesome and beautiful. And the flowers, mile after mile of desert blossoms in every color imaginable. The ground It really looked like a landlocked rainbow, and I fell in love with it. The 6 months I'd planned on being in California stretched into a year. I completed the screenplay, and Eric Char, thank goodness, loved it. However, he still owed me the balance of what he'd agreed to pay, but he wasn't responding to my phone calls. I had little of the advance left, so I wrote a textbook, Tools of the Screenwriting Trade, and I talked to God. I also taught a weekly screenwriting class in Palm Springs, and I made a few friends, not many. Before my arrival, Aunt Betty and I had emailed one another over a long period of time, but I hadn't actually seen her in many years, and I remembered her as a tiny, perfectly proportioned beauty with thick auburn hair and green eyes that had a slightly oriental slant. And men made fools of themselves over her. As a teen, I dreaded bringing a boyfriend home, knowing that they'd forget me the minute they laid eyes on Betty. That's when she lived with us for just a little while. Now, years later, the auburn hair was thinner and white, but she had not one wrinkle. A woman of superb intelligence, hovering near the genius level, actually. She could quote the Bible and Shakespeare, Nostradamus, Plato, and Darwin. Between the time she spent jotting down lyrics for the incredible, beautiful song she composed. Her novel, based on her own youthful experiences as a near-homeless poet, Adobe Bricks, is really a literary marvel. Anyway, after nearly a year in the high desert, there was nothing to do but pack my bag and head out again, despite the fact that I was, once more, dead broke. I remembered, without bothering God about it, that if I lived my life for him, he would answer my prayers, but he would not think for me. Where I went from Betty's was for me to pray about and then make the final decision. As I understood it, God would support my decision, but he wouldn't make it for me. Shadow had gone to the Mount Dora farm family. My lab, Grace, had died of old age, as had my precious Valley. That left me with Mom and Wally's little Shih Tzu, Puggy, and a rescued dingo named Sparks, plus Itzy, my teacher cat. I marveled they had survived the coyotes. Thanking God for my beautiful stay in the high desert, for my lesson in patience, and for all that he had so wonderfully and graciously provided, I packed us into the Chrysler LeBaron. Brooke had moved from New Jersey and was living in Carbondale, Kansas, with her husband and four sons. "Come on, Mom," she urged on the phone. "The attic in this old farmhouse is all fixed up and waiting for you. You'll love it. You can write and find some inspiration here." Well, bless my darling's heart, it is not by accident that Carbondale, Kansas is not on the list of the world's seven wonders. It is many things, but inspirational is not one of them. I had enough screenplay editing assignments while residing in her attic that I was able to go down the road a few miles to the Kansas capital city of Topeka and look for a place to rent. Really captivated by the sight of the Capitol building dome gleaming in the February sunlight, I felt a tug in my heart I had not felt for a very long time. I knew this was where I was meant to be, maybe not forever, but it was clearly the next designated stop on this portion of my earthly journey. As I drove along 32nd Street, a newspaper folded to the rental section, I noticed a charming yellow cottage ahead and to my left. "No way," I muttered to myself. "I don't have that kind of luck that would make that the address I'm looking for." The house appeared to be freshly painted. A peach-colored awning arched over the front door, covered with an abundance of climbing red roses. Just really straight out of a Hansel and Gretel storybook. Pulling up at the curb, I was thrilled to realize it was exactly the address I was seeking. I parked, went inside, and left a few minutes later, proud tenant of one of the most precious places I'd ever seen. Tiny, but hey, I'd learned to live tiny over the past year. In fact, compared to Betty's cabin in my aunt's attic, the cottage was a mansion. I was blessed. During the past year, I seemed to have lost my connection to Dean. I felt God all around me in the high desert, but I'd lost my sense of Dean. No one came to me with unusual stories. No one phoned or felt compelled to tell me of their loss. Where had Dean gone? Why had he gone? Had I so misunderstood whatever it was he was trying to get across to me that he gave up on me? My heart had a huge hole in it again. I longed for some communication from him, but none came. All was strangely silent from the other side, until one morning, not long after moving into the cottage. I had no idea how I was going to pay the $225 utility bills that were due. I went to bed with that thought on my mind, but for some reason I wasn't worried. My eyes snapped open at 5 the next morning when I heard a familiar voice in my head say in no uncertain terms, "Get up and go to the casino." The casino? I didn't even know where to find a casino. I don't gamble. I had no money to throw away gambling. And I had no desire to gamble. Well, it so happened that the couple I rented from went to the casino fairly regularly, and they'd asked me to go along, but I had declined. Now I lay in bed wondering about the voice and the directive to go to the casino. Did I dream it? But then the voice in my head said it again, distinctly. I threw back the covers and I slid out of bed, but I was perplexed. Was my imagination putting tricks on me? I mean, surely God wasn't telling me to go to the casino. Didn't someone once tell me to watch out for the devil disguising himself as God? Well, I dismissed that notion as fast as it arrived. First off, I'm not entertaining any devil. And if there is one, I don't speak to him or acknowledge him. That's for somebody else to be concerned about. My sights are on God and God alone. Well, the urge to go to the casino grew stronger as I dressed. I made myself a cup of tea, mulling over the notion of going to such a place. I wasn't tempted in the least, but if it really was God's directive, well, I didn't want to be one of those who try to outthink the God sonar that directs us away from calamities. If he was nudging me to throw my net where the fish abound, then I should listen. If I needed money, it made sense that he would send me to where the money flows. After all, it isn't money that's evil, it's our attachment to it, especially when it replaces God on our list of priorities, and I didn't intend for that to happen. So, at 7:30, I call my landlady to ask directions to the casino. I had $50 total. I started to take it all like I got in the car, but I felt such a strong urge to take only 30 of it, so I went back in the house to return 20 to a bureau drawer. Then I did the unthinkable. I tooled my way down the highway toward an Indian reservation and their fancy gambling establishment. Inside, there were only a few early morning customers seated at the coin machines. I walked the plushly carpeted aisles, studying the rows of cherry clusters and joker faces. Then I had the strangest sensation that one of the machines was radiating heat toward me. I stopped and frowned at the thing. "Really?" I said to myself. Well, okay. God's sonar at work. I sat down on the stool in front of the contraption and very reluctantly parted with 3 quarters. I couldn't bring myself to let go of 4 of them at once. I mean, that's a whole dollar. I lost about $3, and I was about to consider the entire affair a terrible cosmic misunderstanding when I felt the almost physical nudge to put in 4 quarters. I just couldn't do it. I again put in 3. Well, to my amazement, I won. I would have won more had I put in all 4 quarters, but all I really needed was $225, and I won $255. I quickly slipped from the stool, I collected my winnings, and I got my behind out of there. I went straight to the bank, where I deposited my earnings, and I had my utilities paid before noon. Now, that was on a Wednesday. The following Wednesday, my landlady called to ask if I'd like to go to the casino with them. Well, I told her, no. The trip last week was God's idea. If I went again, it would be my idea, and I'd surely lose. But she'd set the notion in my head. and I kept remembering the sweet sound of those winning bells going off in the otherwise hushed room. I visualized how pretty those little cherries looked lined up across the screen. I was downright artful. Well, I finally gave in, and I snatched up what few dollars I had in my purse, and off I went in search of a ding-a-ling sound and the clink of my winnings. An hour later, I was down nearly $20. That's when I stopped to have a chat with God. I apologized for taking matters into my own hands and being where I clearly had no business being. I told him that I realized the entire room was probably silently buzzing with, "Oh, please, Lord, just let me win one more time," but that I would make him a promise. I said, "You know I can't afford to lose, and I'm so sorry to have been such a fool. But if you'll restore what I've lost, I promise to never set foot in a casino again. I don't ask to win, just to restore. Thank you for hearing me." I slipped 3/4 into the slot and won just over $900. Coincidence? I don't know. Think what you will, but I'm not going back to a casino. All was well for the next few weeks, and then I became ill. I had chills and fever, just really a terrible illness. Beginning sometime immediately after our first Kansas City workshop, and continuing for 9 years afterward, every February or March, Communiversity, an adult education program on the campus of the University of Missouri in Kansas City, flew me in from California and later from Florida to give an intense one-day crash course in screenwriting. I'd arrive the night before, sleep in whatever hotel they chose to put me in, get up blurry-eyed and much too cold very early the next morning, cram a bagel in my mouth, wash it down with hot tea, and let myself be whisked to a campus lecture hall by Communiversity's very terrific director, Rick. An exhausting, for me and for the students, 8-hour, non-stop session followed. We didn't even break for lunch. It was called a brown bag screenwriting workshop, and brown bag it is what we did, while continuing to work straight through. The only break in those workshops came during the time I was in the mountain cabin writing Eric Char's screenplay. Now that I was living in Topeka, so close to Kansas City, I got in touch with Rick to let him know that I was available to teach if they could use me, and he seemed delighted to set me up with one class a week. I was due to start soon, but I was flat on my back. With all of my possessions in Florida storage, I was fortunate that my landlord provided me with a few necessities. I picked up the rest of what I needed from a local flea market. And my little cottage, oh, it looked as charming inside as it did on the outside. I marveled constantly at my good fortune, even as I lay on the sofa, unable to do more than make an occasional trip to the bathroom. I suspected that my concern about lack of money was at the root of my illness. I was still owed the last of my pay from the screenplay, but with 2 moves since hearing from Eric Char, it was unlikely he would know even where to send a check if he had any intention of doing so in the first place. I continued to try to reach him, but really to no avail. I spoke to a friend of his at one point who said that Eric was in Europe on an extended business trip. He was now dealing in international art, and it had been, nearly 8 months since there'd been any communication at all. On the evening of the third day of my illness, I was lying on the sofa, facing the wall, talking to God. I remember saying, "God, if I lived in another time, in another place, I'd find out where Jesus was staying and I'd go there. I'd push through the crowd and touch the hem of his gown and I'd be healed. It would be that simple. He would heal me with his touch." I closed my eyes, visualizing myself in the presence of Jesus. I imagined how it would be to reach out to him. And then I actually saw him. I did. I saw Jesus. I was facing the wall, and when I opened my eyes, I saw Jesus with his back to me. In my mind, I reached out and touched him. I could feel the coarse texture of his garment. It was like burlap, but not quite so stiff. But lying there on the sofa, I rubbed my fingers together, in awe of the fact that I could feel the fabric. Jesus turned just enough to look over his shoulder, and his expression seemed to say, "Who touched me?" It was not a benevolent look. There was no piety in his eyes. They were dark and firm, demanding with his expression to know who touched him. In that instant, our eyes met. I felt a jolt go through my body. It was clearly as if I remembered having had this happen. I recognized him. I recognized the look he gave me. I recognized the situation. And once again, I was healed. I fell into a peaceful sleep, and it was the first one in, maybe 3 nights. When I awoke, the phone was ringing. It was a friend of Eric Char's. Eric wanted to know where they should send the balance of my fee. 2 days later, it arrived. So, where is Dean in this story? Where he always was, in my heart. He had led me to God in a way I'd never known him before. But now it seemed that Dean had gone on to other things, and I was left to wonder what I was supposed to do with all of the stories from all of the people that he had sent my way. Maybe, since I didn't know and couldn't seem to figure it out, he simply stopped sending them, and I felt I had let him down terribly. I began teaching Saturday morning classes at Communiversity. As I had in all of my workshops I'd given since Dean's crossing, I explained that my work was the result of what I wish I had done for Dean. I let them know that their success was important to me, because it would be Dean's success as well. When I started putting together my notes for this book, I found an email sent to me by one of the Communiversity students, and I had to smile when I read it because, don't forget, I thought Dean had left me. I thought he was no longer sending me those who needed my help. I asked permission to use the student's name, and it was granted. So this is his real name, and this is his real story. Thursday, October 31st, 2002. Esther, I'm so glad you're writing this book. I had no idea there were others out there who were guided to you as I was. My father passed away in April of 1999. He was a wonderful man and an even greater father to me. He started his family later in life, so when I was old enough to play sports, he was a bit too old to keep up, but that didn't stop us from bonding. What my father and I really liked to do was watch movies together. I can't tell you how many times I stayed up late with him and watched the old-time classic movies like Body and Soul, Grapes of Wrath, The Hustler, Cool Hand Luke. The list could go on and on. His favorite movies, however, were westerns. I think I've seen every western that was ever made. He would read Zane Grey's western novels and talk to me all the time about them. He was truly a joy to be around. In early 1999, his health really began to fade. My mother would call me when he wasn't around and tell me how bad he was getting. He and my mother made plans to visit me in Kansas for the Easter holiday. My mother told me he really got re-energized and was so excited about the trip. When he arrived, we spent a great deal of time together and, you guessed it, watched movies. The night before he left, we watched a western movie called Hombre with Paul Newman, and we really enjoyed it together. The next day, we said our goodbyes and he went back home. He passed away 2 weeks later. I think God let him stay and be alive long enough for us to see one last good western together. After he died, I felt very depressed. In my solitude, all those westerns I had watched with him kept coming to me. I got a crazy idea to write my own western, one that I know he would love to see. As I wrote down my thoughts, and this may sound weird, I felt as if he was with me. My grief diminished, and I was happy. A part of me didn't want to finish the screenplay because I thought I would lose those feelings. But when I finished, the feelings were still there. Now that my screenplay was done, I didn't know where to begin to market it. And this is where you come in. My wife and I only subscribe to the weekend newspaper, so part of my routine is to let the dog out on Sunday morning, get the paper, bring it inside, and never look at it. With three kids, I don't have time to read the newspaper. If I'm lucky, I might browse through the sports section for a second. Well, this one Sunday, for some unknown reason, I brought the paper in and pulled out the accent section, and I never read the accent section. I went immediately to a page with a little 2-inch ad that said, Screenwriters Workshop. I still have the clipping. This, of course, led me to you. Now, I'm a reserved person, kind of an introvert, and need to know somebody pretty well before I tell them personal things. But I just came up to you during the break, and I told you about my father. I believe it was Dean and my father getting us together. Well, that's my story in a nutshell. You can use my name and story if you like. I truly am grateful to have become friends with you. Still no action on my screenplay, and my hope is for someone to give me a chance so I can do this full time. I have so many other stories in my head that I'd like to put down in writing if I only had the time. Sorry I've been so long-winded. If you ever need anything, just let me know. Take care. Larry Fruhoff. My reply. October 31st, 2002, 10:14 a.m. Central Standard Time. Yes, Larry, I do remember the story about your father, and I'm so touched and pleased that you reminded me of it in more detail. And now, this is odd. This morning around 4 or so, I couldn't sleep, so I grabbed a book that I'd picked up at the library the other day. Zane Grey's Rangers of the Lone Star. I've never read a Zane Grey book in my life, and I have no interest. Why'd I get this? I asked myself when I got home from the library. Well, I started reading it this morning, and son of a gun, I'm enjoying the heck out of it. I was reading it at 10 this morning, maybe until noon, and I just thought the timing was interesting. I was reading that book while you were writing your note to me. All my best, Esther. I can't remember now where I was going, but I do know I was on a plane that was making an unscheduled stop. The captain announced that we were going to pick up passengers from a disabled craft that had been headed to the same destination as ours. I make it a rule never to talk to anybody sitting next to me on a plane. First off, I'm not crazy about flying, so I try to sleep the entire way. Secondly, I find it difficult to carry on a conversation with all the racket a plane makes. My ears get plugged, and really there's no amount of gum chewing or heavy swallowing that seems to alleviate the problem. So I simply get a pillow and a blanket, and I curl up against the window, not to be heard from again until we're safely on the ground. On this day, however, a well-dressed gentleman, a businessman, from the disabled plane, settled in beside me with a pleasant hello. I gave him a pleasant hello in return. Then he said something, and I said something back to him, and so it went until I finally realized we were having a conversation. First time ever for me on a plane. The even bigger surprise was that I enjoyed his company. I learned that he worked in a mortgage business, that he was married and had children, and that he came from a large Italian family. And then came the unexpected that I should have expected, but no longer did. May I tell you a personal story? He asked impulsively. His smile was modest, as if he hoped he wasn't imposing. I'd love to hear it, I said, and I meant it. He looked away for a moment, perhaps gathering his thoughts. Then he shared an experience that was so moving, I never forgot it. When he finished, he had tears in his eyes. I've never told that to anyone else, he said. Isn't it funny I would tell it to a stranger on a plane? I repeated to friends the story he recounted to me, and I thought about it often. I always knew that when it came time for me to write this book, I'd dig out his business card and I'd call him to ask his permission to include it in these pages. Well, recently I did just that. The mortgage company he worked for had closed some time before, the victim of the current nationwide economy turndown we were experiencing, he would tell me when I finally reached him. So the work number was no longer valid. I tried another number on the card, plus an email address, and they too were obsolete. I was disappointed, but then I remembered he had written something on the back of the card, and I turned it over. His cell phone rang twice before his pleasant voice responded. I introduced myself and reminded him of our brief encounter on the plane. 6 years ago, he exclaimed enthusiastically. Yes, of course, we were going to North Carolina. I went on to ask if I could include in my book the story he told me that day. When he quickly agreed, I asked if he would recap it in an email, just to make sure I had it right. This is his response, with permission to use his real name. March 30th, 2009, 7:26 a.m. Central Standard Time. Esther. First, I want to thank you for your phone call, also for the opportunity to tell the story of my dad and the impact he had on those around him. My grandfather, Antonio Guida, immigrated from Italy well before World War I. His family had been prominent farmers in the old country. When he came to Ellis Island, he brought with him some clippings from several fig trees he'd had in Italy, and he planted them in his backyard in Brooklyn, New York. The house was an over-under duplex. My grandparents lived upstairs and rented out the lower half. I can remember as a child visiting my grandmother and grandfather. Grandpa's garden always amazed me as he had a tremendous variety of vegetables that grew in the middle of an area known for having no trees. One of the most spectacular of his harvests were the figs that we would pick from the second-story window. They were the size of a man's fist and sweeter than any I've ever had since that time. My grandmother died first. Grandpa subsequently moved from the duplex, but before he left, my father, also named Antonio, made sure to take cuttings from the fig trees. He took them to our family home in Arlington, Virginia, and I remember Dad digging a hole in the ground and then fertilizing it, then carefully placing the tree in the earth. He was very particular with the planting, paying attention to the direction it should face to get the best sunlight. Well, over the years, the tree grew slowly, but it never did produce any fruit. Dad moved its location several times, convinced that it just wasn't in the right spot. Well, it continued to grow, but it never produced a fig. In 1986, after a long illness, my dad passed away. As he was very active in his church and was a friend to everyone he met, his funeral procession was a sight to behold, and it extended for nearly 2 miles. When we got back to the house, Mother went directly to the kitchen while the rest of us stayed in the front room talking. All of a sudden, we heard Mother scream. We went running, thinking the service had been too much for her, or that she'd taken ill. My brothers and I bound into the room to find her staring outside at the fig tree that had never bore fruit, but which was now heavy with figs. As the summer progressed, the tree began delivering more fruit than we could eat. As a result, we shared bags of them with friends and neighbors to their delight. Once again, Dad had reached out and touched so many people. It is evident that those we love have a connection to us long after their bodies have left this plane. Thanks again for letting me share my story. Sincerely, Charlie Guida, Potomac Falls, Virginia. You know, I find it interesting that I'd been so concerned about Dean's silence. I worried about the people he'd sent me whose stories were amazing and heart-rending, but baffling, because I didn't know what to do with them. Then the people and their stories stop coming, until one day I get on a plane that makes an unscheduled landing, picks up passengers who had no reason to be there except for an accident with their craft, and one of them happens to sit next to me. On top of that, I talk to the only seatmate I've ever talked to in all my years of flying, and he tells me the story of his father and his father's message from the other side, a story he had never before shared with anyone else. Was there an angel on my shoulder again? Was he saying something to me like, I'm right here, Mom. I never went away, but there are so many stories, and you don't seem to get what it is I'm trying to do. Then, did he maybe take a deep breath and add, All right, Mom, I'm going to give you another chance, so pay attention.
You've been listening to Dear Dean, Love, Mom, told by its author Esther Luttrell, and brought to you by The Voice of Helona in association with Mojave Beach Productions. The Voice of Helona theme was composed and performed by David Randa of Fesleyan Studios. Patrick McGranahan produced. This production was recorded by Dean Fairweather. Funding for Dear Dean, Love Mom was made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the support of all aspects of forgiveness in families, communities, businesses, and personal relationships. Visit their website at forgivenessfoundationinternational.com. This is Jeff Evans, inviting you to soar on the wings of imagination to Mojave Beach Productions' World of Audio Entertainment.
Mojave Beach Productions.
I just want to take a moment to thank you for soaring with us on the wings of imagination as you listen to stories we're having so much fun creating for you. If you enjoy what you hear, take a moment to subscribe to Mojave Beach Productions on your favorite podcast app. And thanks a million.